CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. Listener-driven radio.
Look at what's happened to me. I can't believe it myself. Suddenly I'm up on top of the world. It should have been somebody else. Believe it or not, I'm walking on air. I never thought I could feel so free. Flying away on a wing and a prayer. Who could it be? Believe it or not, it's just me. From out of the blue, breaking me out of the spell I was in, making all of my wishes come true. Believe it or not, I'm walking on air. I never thought I could feel so free. Flying away on a wing and a prayer. Who could it be? Look at me, falling for you.
Welcome to the Meta World Stupaloop Show. I am your host, IMA Karen Elliott. Today, the second part of our look at art theft. It's really what made the Mona Lisa famous. A contractor pinched it in 1911. The scream has also been pilfered, a couple of times. It's a heist-oriented show. A little more action-packed and perhaps a little more narratively sensible than usual. The narratives do have some recurring features. None of the heists are really all that smart or elaborate. Most of them involve just taking stuff, some of them even in broad daylight in full view, and most of them without any sort of confrontation whatsoever, let alone violence. Bad planning on behalf of the reputable and respected institutions that were charged with their care is certainly part of the deal, which is ironic given that these very institutions' abilities to keep things all safe and guarded is very much part of their argument why so much of their ill-gotten works should not be returned, whether to the victim nations of colonialism or even the victims of Nazi looting. For such haters of modern art, the Nazis did lead to the marketing of a lot of it. No, the alleged looting of the Ukraine in this past round of war there is not included. Do you people not have anything better to do? Oh yeah, not really so much in that vein. These art thefts do not include the sort of mass looting of artifacts that was expensively covered in our series last year. That is available in archive through archive.org. It's strange when archetypes say, the canvas is still missing. What are we supposed to believe, that the thieves left the paint behind and just removed the canvas? I mean, come on. How stupid do you take us for? Art napping is a dumb word. The art is not napping, it died decades, some of it even centuries ago. What we are left with is the Meta World Stupaloop Show on CKUW. I am your host. I am A. Karen Elliott, and this week on the show, Art Heist. Part 2.
Society, who were patrons to the local gallery. The Museum of Fine Art is home to many priceless works of art, among them Goya's, Velázquez, and Van Dyck's. The most valuable pieces in the collection are two small sketches by the Flemish master, Rubens. Painted in 1636, they hang side by side. La Coruña is a peaceful place. September 16, 1985 is a quiet day. A man wearing a dark coat enters the Museum of Fine Art. The museum has no high-tech security system and only two security guards to watch over the entire gallery. The man in the black coat admires Rubens' work. When the security guards are not looking, he gets to work stealing the sketches. Using an ordinary screwdriver, he quickly pries the paintings out of their frames.
That the paintings remain there. They never even bothered to answer the letter.
After Minister Görer had blocked any further discussion over the restitution of the five Blockbauer Klimts, Randy wrote to her directly, saying in all fairness, she should consider arbitration.
And her response to me was, in writing, if you don't like the way we've dealt with the law, you have to go to court.
The Austrians must have felt confident that Randy and Maria wouldn't sue in Austria, as Maria would have to put down a large deposit reflecting the value of the painting. But they hadn't bargained for the tenacity of the American lawyer.
In this case, it would have been almost several million dollars for Maria just to initiate a lawsuit. So we tried to reduce that, and the judge said, well, yes, Maria Altman, you don't have to pay more than everything you own. You just have to pay everything you own. and literally all of her assets other than her home, she would have had to pay to start the litigation in Austria. And then Austria appealed and said the amount should be even higher than that. So at that point, let's forget about suing in Austria. Let's see if we can sue in the United States.
That was something Austria never thought possible. Randy had succeeded in endearing himself to the court.
That opened everything for him because all the other judges smiled. From that moment, he had the judges on his side.
It must have had a good impact, and it just seemed really, at the end of it, it seemed like we had a chance of winning, which was a big surprise.
Without a second thought. Meanwhile, inside the museum are two security guards, Rick Abbath and Randy Hestend. Abbath is a veteran security guard who often works the night shift, and Hestend is working the night shift for his first time. Per museum security policy, one guard is to patrol the galleries while the other sits at the front security desk. Being more experienced, Abbath grabs his flashlight and heads on patrol first. As every other night, it's business as usual. Nothing appears out of the ordinary. Everything in its rightful place. Abbath calmly walks from one hall to the next, following his usual routine. After one final trip through the rooms, he starts walking back to the desk. Then, all of a sudden, multiple fire alarms. Startled, Abbath quickly rushes toward the source of the sound. But he finds nothing. No hint of smoke, no trace of fire. Confused but contained, he heads to the security room and locates the fire alarm control panel. The panel indicates smoke in multiple locations. He scratches his head. Having already checked the rooms, he chalks it up to a malfunction and resumes patrol. Before completing his rounds, Abbath does something strange, something he doesn't usually do. He pauses at the side entrance of the museum and briefly opens the side door before shutting it again. Abbath returns to the front security desk around 1 a.m., at which point Hestend takes over patrol.
Ironically, at the time of the robbery, the museum was in the midst of updating their outdated security.
I can't imagine if I was upgrading my home security and in the couple days that I was
a security guard at the museum by night. By his own admission, he would sometimes show up for work drunk or stoned after around 12:54 a.m., a half hour before the thieves had successfully entered the building. A fire alarm went off on the third floor of the museum.
When committing a robbery, every split second counts. Thieves can be incredibly sophisticated and sometimes pull off million-dollar robberies within the blink of an eye.
Take a gun and a hammer. The man smashes all of the glass casings and helps himself to some highly expensive jewelry. He takes $3.4 million worth of jewels and then speeds off. The gang had come and gone within the space of 170 seconds. It was
all because of me, for that matter.
Monet was born in the 9th arrondissement of Paris in 1840. At the age of five, Monet with his family moved to the coastal town of Le Havre in Normandy. His father had aspirations for him to go into the family grocery business. But from a young age, Monet knew his future would be in art.
We know from early on that he was drawing caricatures at school, he was doing little charcoal drawings, so he always had this kind of budding interest in art.
As a young person, he was showing and selling work, which sort of means two things. It means that, you know, he's rather good at art, but also with a keen eye for making a bit of money.
in love. He trained with somebody called Orchard, who I think I'd never heard of particularly, but turns out to have been a pupil of David.
Jacques-Louis David was a neoclassical French painter who was known for his austere and moral history paintings. One of his students, Jacques-François Orchard, was in turn the teacher of Monet. However, it would be an encounter with the landscape artist Eugène Boudin in Honfleur that would set Monet on the course, which would determine the rest of his artistic output.
Boudin was one of the first people in French painting to be very interested in capturing weather conditions, and this is what he first began to teach Monet to do himself.
Representing the changing seasons, the changing atmosphere, really reflecting what it felt like to be in that landscape.
Norwegian police recovered the screen, one of the most famous and powerful images in art history. In August 2006, Norwegian police recovered the screen, one of the most famous and powerful images in art history. In the past 12 years, it has been the target of thieves not once, but twice. Edvard Munch painted the image many times. One version, stolen in 1994, was recovered. But a decade later, another screen vanished when thieves walked into the Munch Museum in Oslo and ripped it from the walls, along with a second Munch masterpiece, the Madonna.
And hides them in his coat pocket.
The world's media are gathering in an Oslo.
The paintings had a very simple frame, so it was easy to take them out. There was some damage, not because it was difficult, but because they were old and fragile, because they were from the 17th century.
The thief is able to walk out of the museum before anybody notices the paintings are missing. It could not have been simpler.
2 years earlier, shocked not only Norwegians, but art lovers across the globe.
The robbery was very easy because of the simplicity of the location. It had no system or ways of stopping them being stolen.
No clues were left at the scene, and the police had no leads. The two Rubens sketches just disappeared. Peter Paul Rubens was one of the greatest artists of the 17th century and the master of the Baroque style. Because of his fame, the demand for Rubens' work was huge. To keep up with this demand, Rubens ran a studio employing every able painter in Antwerp.
Rubens, for each picture, would paint an autograph, an authentic oil sketch. Sketch is perhaps a misleading word, because it was really a model, close to what an architect does with his blueprints.
And so I just floated out of the room, and I was so happy, and everybody congratulated me.
The room was filled with men, all lawyers. They came running up to me, and they said, "Maria, it looks fabulous." And I said, "How can you tell? Nobody said anything."
Skills. And today I'm meeting them for the first time over a. I'm really hoping they're going to agree to help me win this wager.
This painting in the world. The story of the theft is quite interesting. The guy that did it was an Italian called Vincenzo Perugia, and he shut himself in a broom cupboard on a Sunday night in the gallery, knowing that the place was going to be closed on the Monday for cleaning. So early hours of the Monday morning, he comes out the cupboard, takes this off the wall, gets to the front door and can't let himself out because it's locked. So brilliantly, he smashes the doorknob off from the inside and then goes and finds a member of staff and says, "The doorknob's been stolen, can you let me out?" You know, he's doing this with the Mona Lisa, which is under his arm. So this member of staff sorts the door out and lets him out, and he walks out with it. The best part for me is the fact that for a full day after this happens, there's a big gap on the wall.
Thank you.
I know. Everything about it is appealing. Stealing everything.
Randy flew back to Los Angeles, uncertain whether he had won or lost. No sooner had he arrived than he got some bad news.
I got home and I opened up the legal newspaper here in Los Angeles, and the headline was, "Court likely to reverse Altman case." That we were going to lose. And so I called up the reporter. And I said, you know, how could you say this? Everybody thought it went so well. And he said, trust me, I've been reporting the Supreme Court for 35 years. You don't stand a chance.
And no one notices. The Mona Lisa's gone. No one says anything until a visitor mentioned it to a member of security and said, oh, what's happened to the Mona Lisa? And the security guard says, oh, I think it's being photographed. So nobody paid any attention to it. And it is amazing how much you miss, even though it's happening right in front of you. So you should.
It's now 1:20 a.m., and the two police officers from earlier drive up to the side entrance, park, and walk to the side door. The door that Abbott mysteriously opened and closed. They ring the buzzer. Nobody answers. So they ring it again. A brief pause, then they hear a voice. Abbott answers through the intercom. Police explain that they are investigating a disturbance. Abbott sees them on the closed-circuit TV and notices they're wearing police uniforms. So at 1:24 a.m., he lets them in. They confidently approach Abbott at his desk and ask if anyone else is in the museum. Abbott radios to his partner to return to the security desk. The first police officer tells Abbott that he looks familiar. He then explains that they have a warrant for his arrest. Abbott cooperates and steps away from the desk. Out of nowhere and without hesitation, the officer forces Abbott against a wall and handcuffs him. At the same time, Heston walks into the room. And now the second officer grabs him and does the same. With both security guards now detained, the officers lead them to the basement and secure them to a sturdy pipe. One of the officers kneels down to the two men, handcuffed to the pipe, leans in closely, and says, "Gentlemen, this is a robbery."
You are watching.
Shutting the door behind them, both of the thieves lock the men in the dark basement and walk back up the steps. Back into the museum. The thieves move through the museum unopposed, their movements captured on infrared motion detectors. They begin in the Dutch room, smashing frames and taking what art they can carry. They find that as they get too close to the paintings, a small surveillance device begins beeping. They quickly smash these devices, leaving shreds spread across the gallery floor. At 1:51 a.m., the thieves move to a section of the museum known as the Short Gallery.
Climax. Johnny Brenna, the undercover Norwegian detective. Jorun Christofferson, a senior official at the Munch Museum where the paintings were stolen. Morten William Arvik, the police prosecutor who had pieced together the evidence. And Thomas Natos, one of the defendants who claimed all along he was the victim of the ruthless gang which carried out the raid. The prosecution, have asked for sentences of up to 12 years in prison. The defendants have throughout protested their innocence. As the judge enters to deliver the verdict, there's an expectation that the thieves who carried out the audacious daylight raid to steal the screen will finally be known. It was a warm summer Sunday morning in 2004, shortly after opening time at the Munch Museum in Oslo. There were about 70 people in the gallery. At 11:05, a car pulled up alongside the main building. Two men got out and ran toward the entrance of the museum.
Everything about it is appealing, stealing everything that traffic will allow.
Wearing gloves and hooded sweatshirts, one was carrying a gun. The two armed thieves burst into the museum, shouting and screaming at terrified gallery goers. They forced guards to the floor at gunpoint. As they made their way to the far side of the gallery, they threatened visitors, yelling and waving the gun as they went.
They kind of coalesced as a gang, really, the impression is. So he's there with Manet and Renoir, and they're all, you know, painting each other wildly. And also he buys a little flat-bottom boat, which I think is so sweet, and starts painting.
He had Renoir out there, Manet, and Manet actually painted a couple of pictures of Monet at work. So we see him working in his boat, which was his sort of studio boat, specially crafted so that he could cruise around on the water, capturing the effects of light on water, the changing ripples, the reflections. That was something that he was continually fascinated with.
Impressionism is only direct sensation. All great painters were less or more impressionists.
The paintings of Turner.
So he was looking at those amazing seascapes, landscapes, changing weather, quite dramatic, very free. He's almost the impressionist before impressionism.
As a city, London would also leave a lasting impression on Monet and his developing technique.
Monet had already begun to paint in a very experimental, brightly colored manner in the very late 1860s, 1869.
One of the most brazen
art heists different conditions of light
in U.S. history went down in an unlikely place.
A scene so unbelievable, one would think it was a movie.
We were taking our cues from film and TV.
Four middle-class college students decided to become art thieves.
And the crime shocked Lexington and became one of the city's most notorious, the Transylvania Book Heist.
We were all 19 years old.
Some of it was just so amateurish. I mean, my grandkids could have done a better job.
I trained the gun on his face.
He's pointing a gun at Chaz. Chaz is pointing a gun at him.
And everything kind of came together and came crashing down at that moment. Brash and angry. My parents went through divorce, and I found myself at odds.
You were bored. You were a little bored.
Lexington is it's a small town, and it's the type of place where everyone seems to know everyone. I grew up worth about $12 million in this one special collections room. What would it take to get those?
Buried within the musty manuscripts of the special collections room sits more money than you'd find in most bank vaults.
Transylvania University's special collections has a particular specialty in natural history books.
We were actually watching heist films for inspiration.
Located on the second floor. They turned to the paintings they came for. They focused on Rembrandt and Degas. Masterpieces.
When they reached their targets, the screen and the Madonna, Munch's most famous works, they brutally snatched them from the walls. The two thieves ran out of the museum and across the lawn to their getaway car. As they drove off, they had in the back of their car $100 million worth of some of the most important art of the last two centuries.
See what I mean? I'll give you an example. An ordinary deck of 109 playing cards.
109?
Mm. And, Pauline, if you don't mind, would you take one out for me? Anyone you like. Just grab one out for me. Anyone you like. Thank you.
Shy. Thank God I don't feel like that anymore. I just feel 74, and that's good. I love being retired. I love being able to do things because I want to do them, because there's something I feel passionately about, perhaps, or just...
It's the 1980s.
It's all over. And I said, well, you know, some of the justices didn't even open their mouths. He says, I can tell by the body language. You lost.
It was the spring when the case was heard in Washington. But it was the fall in Los Angeles when Randy finally learned the result.
3 months later, I'm making breakfast for the kids, and I get this call from the reporter. He says, hello, this is Dave Pike. And I said, okay, well, give me the bad news. He said, no, not bad news. You won. I said, you're kidding. He said, no, 6-3 decision by Justice Stevens. I literally couldn't believe it. But it was coming from him. I had to believe it. And so, you know, I tried to call Maria, and her phone was busy, and then we finally got together. And just, I mean, the celebration was enormous. But very quickly we realized, wait a second, what did we just win? Nothing, right? All we won was the right to start the case in Los Angeles. The paintings were still in Vienna. We hadn't won anything. We just won the right to start.
It may have been just the beginning for Randy, but the judgment put the Austrian government in a difficult position. They may have been anxious to throw off their Nazi past, but now the case had attracted media interest from around the world.
Now the U.S. Supreme Court had basically weighed in and said, okay, well, you can hear it in U.S. court. U.S. courts tend to be more favorable in these cases. However, the Austrians could have appealed, as they had appealed some of the other decisions in the past.
And as our prices... ...the target, thanks to its peerless collection of old masters. When it opens in 1903, the Gardner boasts the largest private collection of art in America. The two thieves have a clear, detailed plan. They start by approaching the museum, wearing stolen police uniforms. The only question is, will their disguises work?
So, there they are, outside the door. There's a closed-circuit TV camera, shining right down on them. Inside the museum, less than 30 feet away, Enric sees these two men announcing themselves police officers. We're here to investigate a disturbance. What disturbance? There's no disturbance here.
And to kind of psych ourselves up to actually turn this fictional thing into reality. So the original idea to use disguises, it was actually an offshoot of an inspiration from the film Snatch. So in Snatch, they disguise themselves as Hasidic Jews. We kind of created a variation off of that. We came up with old men. We actually created facial putty masks, complete with makeup and wrinkles to make us look aged, bald caps, hats, and suits that we purchased from thrift stores.
The whole robbery had taken less than 5 minutes. News of the robbery spread quickly. But what puzzled the people of Oslo was, why had the Scream been targeted once again? And how on earth did the thieves imagine they were going to sell the world's most famous image? One of the first to hear about the loss of the Munch masterpieces was the museum's head of public relations.
I was called up by a friend. I was at home, it was a Sunday, and she said, I heard something on the radio. There is a robbery on the Munch Museum. And the Scream and the Madonna were gone.
As Jorunn Christoffersen rushed to the museum, Oslo police arrived at the scene.
It was small, but it gave all the lines, the colors, the information that his assistants would need to render the full-size picture. So it was a work of art in its own right, and even in Rubens' day, was collected, was kept as a valuable picture on the wall.
Even today, the stolen sketches have an estimated value of $1.5 million each.
But when I have time, I want to go through this painting.
Gorel was busy and needed more time to study the painting in detail. She had no inkling of its suspect provenance.
Time passed, days passed, and there wasn't really time. And then he suddenly phoned and said, the friend wants the painting back. He only was the messenger for a friend.
Harold Leith wanted to come and collect the painting that very afternoon. Gorel had minutes to research the sketch. She turned to the definitive work on Rubens by Professor Julius Held.
I hurried to the library and got Julius Held's book on Rubens' oil sketches. And I flipped through the book and I saw this particular painting. So my first reaction was, is this a copy or is it the original? I looked very thoroughly, and you can recognize a copy. There is always some details that are different. It's best with very good black and white photographs where you can see the details very clearly.
But to have this dragging on in the public view during these appeals as an issue that really, at this point, was not going to go away, I think was a very difficult quandary for the Austrians.
But it wasn't just the Austrian government that was in a precarious position. Randy's client was now 89. Could he risk a lengthy court case? If she died, his case was over. She had no other relatives living in the United States who could continue the case. It took a year of negotiations, but eventually both sides agreed to a do-or-die arbitration.
I went behind closed doors with Maria and I said, Maria, this is the greatest thing. We can have this arbitration. We can get it finally finished, and by your 90th birthday next February, it'll all be over with. And isn't that great? And she said, are you crazy? Why on earth would we go back to Austria when we've just been fighting for 5 years, all the way to the Supreme Court and back, to have the right to try the case in front of this wonderful judge here in Los Angeles?
I said, you're crazy. Why would three Austrian arbitrators go against their government and give us the paintings when for 8 years they kept saying? And he said, we have to take the chance.
Having convinced Maria, Randy flew to Vienna. The game was on. He was going to gamble everything. The Klimts were probably worth over $100 million. Who had the strongest hand?
Randall was very skillful at getting his side of the story out. I think he was more skillful than the Austrians in articulating his position in the media.
So when the panel was deciding this case, it was another period of months and months that went by where they were still in this limbo, and you kind of thought anything could happen.
Once again, Randy had no idea whether he had won or lost. He returned to Los Angeles. Then 4 months later, he got an email message.
I came home late one night from a neighborhood poker game where I had lost my shirt, and checked my email, and sure enough, there's an email from the main arbitrator with the decision. And so I opened up the decision, and it's all in German, you know, and my German's pretty good, but it took me a while until I got to the, you know, the part where they said we won. And it was, I was, you know, obviously overjoyed. It was like midnight, it was after midnight on a Sunday night, Monday morning. So I didn't call Maria right away. I let her sleep, and then in the morning we really celebrated. This time we really celebrated.
Because you thought that would be inconspicuous in the library, although it was a college library, so not so much.
We actually did a trial run wearing these costumes. We had to walk across the entire university lawn. We were kind of hobbling and limping, like acting like we were elderly people. And rather than being inconspicuous, our costumes had the opposite effect. We had to abort the mission. After going through that first trial run, I really didn't even want to be involved at all.
One of the first officers there was Lasse Alver, a patrolman on duty in the city at the time.
I arrived on the crime scene approximately 11:20 a.m. When I arrived, the first police unit had already cordoned off the area. Scenes like this, there is a lot of chaos and confusion in the store. What we had to do was try to separate all the witnesses. I guess it was approximately 60 or 70. They were told to go into the cafeteria, and we had to try to find out who had seen something and who hadn't.
When I came to the museum, there was ambulances, police, cars, lots of people, press. I found a museum in shock. The girls at the ticket counter, the girls in the restaurant, they had been the first one to see these robbers.
This was a violent, frightening robbery. And a lot of people, including children, were witness to this crime.
But I agreed to just drive the car. The day of, I picked up the van, came back, and picked up the other two guys who were planning on going into the Special Collection Library. It was a pretty solemn drive. We were just kind of alone with our thoughts. I felt like I was almost underwater.
Among the paintings stolen, the Sea of Galilee, A Lady and Gentleman in Black, The Concert, Che Tortoni, Rembrandt's famed self-portrait. In total, the thieves make off with 13 prized pieces of art that had shaped art culture for hundreds of years.
Maybe they will carry around this for the rest of their lives.
Policy at the Gardner Museum is nobody gets in the museum after it's closed. Even if it's Boston police or law enforcement, what you're supposed to do is call Boston police.
Rick Abbath is familiar with the protocol, but he chooses not to follow it. He lets the two men inside the first door. Thanks to the man trap, he has one more chance to look them over.
Rick, he was very trusting and a good-hearted person. He decided it'd be okay to let him in. And unfortunately, it went totally wrong.
Instead of following protocol, Rick buzzes them in, and the heist is on.
Stealing! Stealing!
When we pull up to the Special Collections Library, we found a parking spot right next to the emergency exit. We had gone in ahead of time to actually cut the alarm on the exit escape. The art student at Transylvania was the lookout because we were worried that someone might recognize him. One of the guys went in. He had originally wanted to use a taser. We had kind of vetoed that. He was supposed to just talk to the librarian and let her know we're here for the books, so please just cooperate with us. It'll all be over soon.
Lipka says to Borsik, grab her hands. And then he's pressing the stun gun into my left arm.
I'm waiting in the van with the other guy, and he gets a call to come up to help carry out the books.
Gooch was stunned and tied up, and she told the Herald Leader that she realized immediately the library was being robbed.
I'm waiting, and it feels like it's taking forever. It was supposed to be in and out.
Very, very exciting. I did not expect it. I was hoping, but because I couldn't imagine, and I still think it is incredibly just that these three Austrian judges unanimously vote for something which their government was so totally against.
Nobody in Austria thought this could happen. They were shell-shocked. These paintings were national icons.
I think it was a wise decision, but it came too late. Of course, Klimt is national cultural heritage of Austria, and his paintings are famous, and we're proud of them. And he is Austrian, and he wanted them to stay in Austria. So Austria needed to find a solution, a diplomatic solution, and they knew they're going to be watched internationally on how they will handle this case. It could have been done smarter. It's done now, but it could have been done smarter, and the damage could have been less.
I think you cannot take a better example for the style of Klimt than to compare the Adele Bloch-Bauer 1 with Adele Bloch-Bauer 2. I mean, we are very sad that from now on, we do not have this possibility anymore in our museum. And this is very sad because this was such a fascinating comparison, which is so unique because you see not only the same person, only 5 years are in between these two portraits, but you see also the change of style, which is in this short period.
Satisfied with their haul, they prepare to leave, but not without checking on the guards to make sure they haven't moved. Paintings in hand, they make a final stop at the security office, where they take the videotapes that recorded their entrance. At 2:40 a.m., more than an hour after their arrival, the thieves move the artwork out of the museum in two trips before speeding away.
Finally, I see one of the guys just kick open the door, running at full speed, and one of the assistant librarians was chasing after him. We open one of the side doors of the van. He dives into the van, and I hit the gas into oncoming traffic, running red lights, running stop signs. They open the backpacks, and we realize that they got all these things. Charles Darwin's On the Origin of Species, an illuminated manuscript from the 1400s, sketches from Audubon. We got away with roughly $1 million worth of rare books.
My name is Pat Murray. I'm a retired police sergeant with the Lexington Police Department. I supervise the Transylvania book heist investigation. I gave them a lot of credit initially. I go, these guys have already come and gone. It's already on a plane. It's down the interstate. It's already sold. It's going to a buyer already. We'll never see this stuff again.
To the night. The robbery lasts 81 minutes in total. Minutes pass, then hours. The next shift of guards arrive later that morning. As they do each morning, They make a call through the buzzer to get let in. No response. They try again. No answer. After trying multiple times without making contact, they realize something isn't right.
At the museum, police began interviewing stunned eyewitnesses and museum staff in an effort to reconstruct precisely how the thieves had carried out the raid. To avoid the guards at the main doors, the thieves entered the building through the cafeteria's side entrance.
Both paintings couldn't be carried by one man. So the one with the gun also had to carry a painting.
Than they had seen in Paris.
Of course, we're familiar with illustrations of Dickens' London, which is pretty dire. All the business of coal going into the atmosphere, that type of fog was actually filtering the colours and the sort of thing that he was seeing so that he could actually see or not see certain things and could actually record the impression of these tenuous forms.
In 1871, Monet left London after being refused inclusion in the Royal Academy exhibition.
Her deathbed, which is a sort of flurry of whiteness. It's a very strange and touching image.
He watched her die and then painted, and he wrote about the process of death, and he was fascinated by it, actually, the transmutation of her face from presumably pink.
And painting.
After the death of Camille, Monet would continue to live in Vétheuil with Alice Ochetay. The death of Ernest in 1891 would give Monet and Alice the opportunity to marry.
There'd be all the plants that he wanted to paint. You know, there were nasturtiums where he wanted them tumbling across the path, so it was quite heavily curated. He extended it and changed it. He added a water garden, which, you know, the nymphaea and the water lilies came from.
He really invested in it. He put in his Japanese bridge. He did a lot of planting of willows and lilies.
His garden is an artwork. I can't think of anybody who...
For me, a landscape does not exist in its own right.
It works in an entirely new and, what many thought, slapdash way.
So there was already this bubbling faction that wanted to show something different, do something different, and there was...
One of the paintings Monet submitted to the exhibition was Impression Sunrise, a land...
The city, what you see is our view of the museum at Lepal. Our picture of the museum is much calmer, is much more structured. Perhaps one of the reasons it's much more structured is that it centers on a big piece of architecture. But if you look at the water in particular, the minute touches of flickering paint that depict it, you see that it is the same imagination at work.
There was also a lot of backlash, people finding it ridiculous, looking at the works and thinking, what is this? I've never seen anything like it, so on, being kind of polymath in himself. But he was best known now as the journalist who coined the term Impressionism.
He was a very bad painter, and as a result was a rather bitter critic, I think, the two.
Particular painting, that was the one that he honed in on, was as rushed as it would be to create a wallpaper design.
People seem to think that it was a very negative review where he uses it.
I'm not performing miracles. I'm using up and wasting a lot of paint.
210 francs. The collector who purchased it was Georges de Bellio. It would then be inherited by his only daughter, Victorine, who bequeathed it to the Musée Marmottin in 1938. This is where the painting resides to this day. Although the term Impressionism had been used before,
the Impressionists were very close in the late 1860s throughout.
After the Impressionists came the Post-Impressionists, which would see Monet's masterpiece, Impression Sunrise, stolen from the Musée Marmottin in Paris.
The theft in 1985 was actually, as art thefts go, pretty dramatic. It wasn't a stealthy thing where someone came in and quickly cut the canvas out. It was almost like a bank robbery.
The forensics people, these were CDs. Not only did we see the emails to the librarian setting up the appointments with her, there were other emails after the fact going to Christie's auction house in New York.
When these guys wanted to take these stolen books to an auction house, I said, there's no way that will actually work. They were positive that Christie's was going to be able to sell the books.
When we saw Christie's auction house, it crossed state lines. We had to bring in the FBI. We had a conference call with Christie's auction house, and they had video of two of our suspects walking in.
The two guys that actually went into Christie's auction house for the meeting, their backstory was that they had a very wealthy relative, and they were there to sell the books on his behalf, and they had fake names and even made fake IDs to go with the fake names.
Then you can compare the lines and the brush strokes and everything. Could see that every line was the same. Well, I thought it looks like the original, you know. It doesn't look like a copy. And so I looked at the back of the book where the catalog was and saw that the painting belonged to a small museum in Spain, which I didn't know. This museum and this city even, I didn't know. So I phoned the Prado.
Que fue, para mí fue una, no, cierta sorpresa, cierta satisfacción, que...
The chief of conservation at the Stockholm Museum, Gorell, phoned me and asked me, as a specialist in Flemish paintings, if the paintings they had were related to any Spanish paintings.
So we phoned the police.
Outside the museum, 50 yards from the entrance, the getaway car had been waiting. But it didn't go unnoticed.
One eyewitness gets sight of the driver.
It was probably one driver in that car. And I said it was probably a black Audi, probably an A4 and A6. We had the latter in the registration number. So that was what we started to search for.
But as they made their escape, the thieves panicked. They thought the frames of the paintings might contain some sort of tracking device. So as they sped through the city, they began breaking up the frames, discarding them out of the car window.
We think they thought there were technical instruments in those frames. There were not, so they had to get rid of the frames quickly.
It left an unusual trail along the Oslo streets.
Actually, I met some of the, you know, the frames around the paintings when I was driving in full.